now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the Left Coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
This podcast is dedicated to the memory of Daniel Shore, a great American journalist. Yeah, we used to have him.
Smiling faces sometimes pretend to be your friend.
This program is supported by listeners. My thanks today to Joe Kells, Teresa Paris, Joe Piper, and Bill Lockemacher. They are voluntary subscribers to the Peter B. Collins Show. If you go to our newly designed website at peterbcollins.com, there's a tab on the right that says You Can Help, and our voluntary subscriptions start as low as $5 a month. It keeps us free of corporate control. In the second half of this podcast, we're going to talk to Dr. Bill Black, Professor Bill Black, from the University of Missouri, Kansas City, where he's professor of economics and law. Bill Black, back in the 80s, helped blow open the savings and loan scandal and exposed the Keating Five because he was there. And Professor Black will offer some unbridled criticism of President Obama's financial reform legislation signed into law this week with great fanfare. So hear me when I'm saying, smiling faces. In our first segment, we get a first-person account of what it's like to be on the receiving end of the Karl Rove political persecution machinery. And for that, we have to dig into the Peter B. Collins tax-deductible music archives for our Alberto Gonzalez theme song. That's the favorite answer of Bush administration officials when called before the Judiciary Committee. And you may remember that in the end of the Bush administration, there was this tug of war, John Conyers trying so hard to get Karl Rove to testify. And finally, he came and talked to the committee behind closed doors. He had serious memory problems, as did his White House colleague, Harriet Myers, who couldn't remember more than 150 times. And all this has a history. And if you've listened to this program, you've heard us talk about it before. It goes back to the massive tobacco settlement in the late 1980s. And a pledge or a pact or some sort of a secret deal between the Republican Party and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and other corporate interests to pack the courts at the state Supreme Court level, and in the federal system with pro-corporate judges and justices. Most evident on the U.S. Supreme Court with Alito, Roberts. But this was a massive effort, and as you'll hear in a few minutes, it was spread in various parts of the country, aimed at neutralizing opponents, mostly Democrats, but not all, as you will hear significantly in a moment. And we have focused on this program on the travesty of justice visited on former Alabama Governor Don Siegelman. I think he's been on our show 15 or 20 times. We talked to him just a couple of weeks ago after the recent Supreme Court decision regarding the Honest Services statute. But down the road in Mississippi, Karl Rove and his operatives were very busy. And one of the people who was caught up in this is a former justice of the Supreme Court of Mississippi who joins us today, Oliver Diaz. Justice Diaz, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on. Glad to be here.
Well, it's a pleasure to talk with you, and I think that you're going to open the eyes of many of our listeners because, frankly, in the research I've done in the past few days in preparation for this interview, I have to say that while I'm a cynical, cold, calculating kind of guy who's seen a lot of stuff come and go, and I've been covering politics since the Nixon era, I was stunned to see the pervasive nature and the expansive nature of the political prosecutions that took place during the Bush-Cheney era. And yours is an interesting one that we'll get to in a couple of minutes. But first, Justice Diaz, I wanted to get your reaction to the report that's finally been issued from a special counsel who was named in the final months of the Bush administration. Nora Danahay was imported from Connecticut and asked to take a look at the firings of U.S. attorneys that occurred. And many people are aware of this. David Iglesias in New Mexico is the most prominent, best known of those who were sacked for political reasons. But this became a huge controversy, as I've referred to. And finally, we have a report. And Scott Horton, who you and I both know, and he's been a guest on our program in the past, he writes for Harper's and teaches law at Columbia University. He described this as a whitewash. And I've read through a summary of the report, and it's just infuriating. Tell me your thoughts on why Ms. Danahy has concluded that no criminal charges are warranted in the political termination of U.S. attorneys for political reasons.
Well, as you can imagine, if you were infuriated reading the report, you can imagine how I felt. I lived through a lot of these injustices perpetrated by the Bush Department of Justice. Ms. Danahy's report, I think Scott is exactly right, Scott Horton, and calling it a whitewash. But what dismays me most is that this whitewash was allowed by apparently our current Attorney General, Eric Holder. He allowed this to occur. The report doesn't actually exonerate Bush officials. It actually says that improper political considerations were taken, but they just couldn't find the stomach to bring criminal charges. And they danced around the issues greatly in not bringing criminal charges. To me, the report is just amazing the way it reads.
Well, and Mr. Diaz, I'm looking at a summary of it in a letter written by Assistant Attorney General Ronald Welch to John Conyers at the House Judiciary Committee.
I've read the letter.
And let me just pull a couple of items out and get you to comment here. And I want to take some pains here. I'm not taking this out of context, but I'm just lifting a few different excerpts. Here's one. The White House under former President George W. Bush fully cooperated with the investigation.
Well, I'm not sure what the definition of fully cooperated with is, but the White House did not want several of these folks to testify. They refused to testify at some point, and Karl Rove refused to testify under oath. He would give statements, and I think as your lead into the program mentioned, there were serious memory flaws in a lot of the answers given by Rove and Myers.
Yeah. And we're not bound by FCC regulations here, Justice Diaz, so feel free to express yourself fully. But in common parlance, this is bullshit. I'm sorry, to say that the White House under George W. Bush fully cooperated is, the emails were deleted. Every effort to get Rove to testify was rebuffed until after the Bush team left office. The obstruction of justice, even if it doesn't meet the technical legal terms, was palpable at every stage of this process.
Well, absolutely. And you've also got to remember that Ms. Danahy is not actually an impartial investigator either. She was a George W. Bush appointee, and she was appointed to lead this investigation by Bush Attorney General Mukasey. So we didn't expect much, but we certainly expected that when the report were presented to the current administration, that they would not simply accept it at face value and accept these premises that they've laid forth. But apparently, I was expecting too much from the current administration.
And here is a piece of legal gymnastics or acrobatics that belongs at Cirque du Soleil. One of the issues raised was about the omnibus clause of 18 U.S.C. Section 1503, and there's a citation from it. It punishes anyone who corruptly influences, obstructs, or impedes, or endeavors to influence, obstruct, or impede the due administration of justice. And Dennehy responds to this by saying that because that clause punishes only endeavors to influence, obstruct, or impede, it penalizes only forward-looking conduct. Therefore, she sought to determine whether Iglesias was fired because of what he had done or what he might or might not do if he remained in office. And this is a bizarre interpretation, and I'm a layperson here. I never studied the law, but I followed it. And to hear this, it's consistent with the incantations of our president, which drive me bonkers, to say that we're only looking forward, we're not looking backward. Well, all kinds of criminal justice proceedings revolve around things that happened in the past. There's very little that we try to deal with that is prospective. And so for this report to say that there's no way to pursue criminal charges because while it appears that Senator Domenici and Republican Congresswoman Heather Wilson improperly tried to get him fired, it didn't rise to the level of a crime because there's no evidence that they were trying to stop him from doing something in the future. This is simply bizarre.
Well, it is simply bizarre, and I think if you boil it down quickly to the fact that I just don't understand how removing someone from their office does not affect their future conduct. To me, that's just bizarre. It's entirely strange. If you're removing that person from their office, they are no longer able to perform any conduct. That's the ultimate act of impeding their administration of their office.
Also related to Iglesias, another quote here. Ms. Dennehy and her investigative team also concluded that the Department of Justice leadership never determined whether the complaints about Iglesias were legitimate and that the fact that the investigation of the complaints about his performance never occurred bespeaks undue sensitivity to politics on the part of DOJ officials. While the actions of DOJ leadership were contrary to DOJ principles, they were not intended to and did not influence or in any way impede voter fraud prosecutions or particular public corruption or a particular public corruption case. Now, what's at issue with Iglesias is that around the 2006 midterm elections, Senator Domenici leaned hard on him to pursue some voter fraud allegations for political purposes.
Made phone calls to his home at night, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, yeah, I've talked to Iglesias about it. He was deeply troubled by the way they were dogging him, and he refused to bring the charges because there was no basis for it. And so somehow to claim that the actions of the senator and the congresswoman and the piling on of justice in Washington to put pressure on Iglesias was not inappropriate, I'm sorry, this just doesn't pass the smell test.
No, it doesn't. And what's telling, though, in the sentence that you read, I think it was the first sentence, that they did admit that there was improper conduct contrary to Department of Justice policies. This is Department of Justice higher-ups, the absolute highest up in the Department of Justice, violating their own internal policies. I think what you've got is the Department of Justice saying in this report that they are going to apply standards to their own employees that they certainly don't provide to defendants they are prosecuting in criminal prosecutions.
That's a very important point. And that gives us at least two standards of justice, if not more. And I've always been laboring under the impression that there was just one and that no one is above the law in this country.
Well, that's what we had hoped as well. You've also got to remember that Ms. Dennehy, in this report, only focused on the Iglesias matter. There was there were allegations that many more U.S. attorneys were improperly influenced, but she chose not to look at those and instead ferried those reports, those investigations off to Office of Professional Responsibility within the Department of Justice, which everyone knows is the Roach Motel where things go but never come out.
Yeah. Well, and Justice Diaz, I open with the Peter Gabriel song about amnesia, I Don't Remember, I Can't Recall. And here, again, quoting from this letter to Conyers, the report concluded that then-Attorney General Gonzalez made a series of statements after the removals that were inaccurate and misleading. And again, I devolved to a street term, bullshit. I mean, it was so clear in the publicly aired testimony from Alberto Gonzalez that he was lying. He was covering up. He was claiming amnesia, and he tripped up over himself as they brought minutes of meetings and timelines and a testimony from underlings about whether or not he had been consulted about these proposed removals. And it was just so clear to anyone. You don't need a lie detector. You don't need a voice stress analyzer that he was serving up lies and deceptive responses.
Well, they admit that the statements are misleading and inaccurate. I think that's just a pretty way of saying that he's lying.
Yeah.
I'm an attorney now in private practice, and I represent criminal defendants. And I've got a defendant that I'm representing in federal court, no less, where there was one single telephone call to an FBI agent, and they said that they didn't believe his statements in that one single telephone call. He's being prosecuted for false statements to a federal officer, two counts from one telephone call. This is our same Department of Justice holding private individuals to a different standard than they are their own employees.
And this is the line here that makes veins pop from my neck. Similarly, this report, the Dennehy investigation, noted that Kyle Sampson made various misleading statements about the United States attorney removals to the White House, Congress, and other department officials. Now, I believe he lied under oath before the Judiciary Committee, and his famous line was that he wanted to take this issue, gum it to death, and run out the clock. Now, that is not only a statement of intent, but of motivation to mislead or deceive those that he was testifying before. How can Kyle Sampson be not vindicated? He clearly is not vindicated in this report, but we are not going to pursue any kind of accountability actions against him.
Well, I think these are the kind of questions that that the current attorney general needs to answer. I think they were hoping that they could issue just some small report like this and hope that no one noticed late in the summer in Washington when everybody's focusing on other things, the president's away on vacation, and people aren't paying much attention to politics. They come out with this type of report, hoping that nobody notices. You know, this whole report focuses on U.S. attorneys who were removed because they failed to engage in the political process that the Bush administration wanted them to. They wanted them to engage in political prosecutions. It's frightening. If you think about it, that these are the folks who did the right thing. They refused to engage in political prosecutions. The flip side of that coin that not many people have thought about, if there were influences on U.S. attorneys and they did not bring political prosecutions, were there some U.S. attorneys out there who did in fact bring these political prosecutions? And I think what we're finding out now is that all across the country, there were U.S. attorneys who were willing to work with the White House and the administration under the Bush regime in bringing political prosecutions for political purposes.
Well, and since you mentioned that, I want to thank you because you referred me to a website that I'm about to mention here where there is a documentary of about 50 minutes long that I really recommend that people look at. It's the website is politicalprosecutions.org. And if I'm not mistaken, your client, John McTiernan, produced and he appears, and I think he did the voiceover, in this documentary.
That's correct. John McTiernan, for folks who don't know, is a movie director. He actually has directed blockbuster hits in Hollywood, such as Predator, The Hunt for Red October, Die Hard, The Thomas Crown Affair, and many other Hollywood blockbusters. He actually is the client that I was referring to earlier when I said that there was a telephone call to his home late one afternoon from the FBI. They didn't feel like he was telling the truth in that phone call, and so they prosecuted him for lying to a federal official. John began looking into prosecutions across the country by the Bush administration and noticed this pattern. He put together this very, very powerful documentary that you're referring to at politicalprosecutions.org. I highly recommend everybody look at it. It's amazing when you look at this documentary that John did. Look at the scope of these prosecutions across the country. It didn't just happen to Governor Siegelman in Alabama. That's probably the most famous case. Mm-hmm. But it was occurring all across the United States. We believe it began before 2004 when the Bush administration was looking forward to that 2004 election. They were looking to see who possible opponents for the Bush presidency might be. I think they identified Hillary Clinton, John Edwards, and a couple of others. And what they did was began to investigate political donors to those potential opponents. And when they did so, they began bringing prosecutions of a lot of the powerful political donors in a hope to cut off the funding for these opponents for the Bush administration.
And what is the total number chronicled in this documentary, Justice Diaz? Do you recall?
I don't recall the number, but it's
over it's 200.
Yeah, it's in the hundreds, yes.
Yes.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Now, one of the things that gave me a little pause is that Kwame Kilpatrick, the former mayor of Detroit, is listed along with many others in the scroll at the end of this documentary. And I have a hard time including him with you and Governor Siegelman and others because his case, at least what's been disclosed publicly, is pretty much of his own creation. So I don't want to get too bogged down in that, but I just want your comment on that because Kilpatrick is a guy who appears very corrupt to me and appears to have deserved the prosecution that he got.
Yeah, I think you're right. When John put the video together, the documentary, I don't think he tried. He wanted to list all of the political figures who were prosecuted under the under that time period when the Bush administration was in effect. He didn't attempt. It was an all-inclusive list. He wasn't trying to make a statement on guilt or innocence of those parties, but he wanted to list all of the political figures who were prosecuted during that time.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. So, Justice Diaz, I'd like you to take a few minutes here because I realize that there's a great deal of detail to your case. But I'd like to begin just with a quick bio and correct me if anything here in Wikipedia is wrong. But before you became a judge, you spent 7 years in the lower house of the Mississippi legislature, and you were a city attorney in a town that needs a vowel, Dibblerville?
D'Iberville. A French explorer.
Okay. And then the judgeships in Mississippi are generally elected. So you were elected to the Court of Appeals in November of 1994, served 6 years there. And then here's where I think it's important to note that you are a Republican. And if I have it correctly, you were appointed by Democratic Governor Ronnie Musgrove. And then you had to stand for election. Is that right?
Everything you've said is correct so far.
Okay. And so you were elected to an 8-year term in January of 2001. And then when did the stuff start to hit the fan and you became aware that you were a target?
Yeah, that's what's interesting. I was elected, as you said, the election was November of 2000. And began my term in January of 2001. Sometime around the summer of 2002, we learned that we were being investigated. When I say we, it's myself and Paul Miner, who you'd mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. Paul Miner was actually the largest Democratic donor in the state of Mississippi. He made a great deal of money as a trial lawyer, and made most of his money from the tobacco litigation of the late 90s when some trial lawyers brought suit against the major tobacco companies.
Mm-hmm.
Paul used his money. His hobby was politics, and he enjoyed being involved in politics. He was one of John Edwards' top 10 political contributors before the 2004 election, and way before Mr. Edwards got into his recent trouble. But Mr. Miner enjoyed dabbling in politics, and he was the largest single donor in the state of Mississippi. He contributed heavily to Ronnie Musgrove, who was the governor and a good friend of mine. We served in the legislature together. And he also was the largest donor to my campaign for the Supreme Court. We both were from the same hometown. He knew me well and knew that our political philosophies were in alignment. But because Paul was such a good friend and such a large donor, I told him at the very outset that because of his contributions and his friendships that I would never vote on any of his cases while I was a judge on the Mississippi Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't. I did not. And so we learned that we were being investigated in 2002, and I sort of laughed it off at the time. I said, they're going to quickly find out that there were allegations of being bribed by Paul Miner in his cases, and I said, they're going to quickly find out that I'd never voted on any of his cases.
Now, Mr. Diaz, just for detail, how much did he contribute? And then he co-signed a loan for you after you were elected, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Probably somewhere in the neighborhood of $100,000 total was what he contributed to my campaign.
And the total amount that you raised and spent to get elected?
Oh, it was about probably $1.2 to $1.5 million.
Holy cow, really? That's obscene.
Unfortunately, it is. In 2000, the United States Chamber of Commerce began their campaign to go into states and attempt to defeat judges they did not feel were in line with their philosophy of corporate decisions and folks that ruled in favor of plaintiffs, basically.
Yeah.
And they did not like my philosophy, so they dumped over $1 million against me in that 2000 election.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to fight back as hard as we could.
So
that was the reason for the late campaign loan that Paul Miner had to sign for me, because we had to raise a great deal of money quickly to respond to the U.S. Chamber, who came in at the very last minute.
I see. Okay. And so what was the amount of that loan that Miner co-signed or guaranteed for you?
I think it was $75,000 to $80,000.
Okay,
it was.
All right.
Somewhere in that neighborhood. Yeah.
Great. So we've got those details. So go ahead forward. The investigation started in 2002. You laughed it off at first, and then.
There were constantly leaks to the media that from the U.S. Attorney's Office about witnesses that they were calling before the grand jury to investigate this massive bribery scheme that they were attempting to uncover. And we quickly realized that they were going forward with their investigation. It culminated in August of 2003 with an indictment. We were actually indicted in August of 2003 under allegations of bribery and mail and wire fraud.
And this turned out to be the first of two indictments, actually.
It did. But mm-hmm. What's interesting about the timing in August of 2003, Mississippi's gubernatorial election is in off years, and it was in November of 2003. That's when Haley Barbour, former RNC chairman, Republican Party chairman,
right,
decided that he was going to come back to Mississippi and run for governor. The indictments were curiously timed for 3 months prior to that election.
Mm-hmm.
Paul Miner had been the major contributor to Ronnie Musgrove, the gubernatorial candidate, and to me. And Governor Barbour used those indictments heavily in his campaign, trumping up the fact that Governor Musgrove's political contributions were coming from an indicted lawyer, and also his Supreme Court pick was also under indictment. So it was used politically at the time to assist Barbour in running for governor.
And Justice Diaz, in the Siegelman case, we have the very clear conflict of interest of the U.S. attorney. Laura Canary was married to Bill Canary, a former business partner of Karl Rove's and a guy who remained in close touch with him. Tell us about Dunica Lampton, the U.S. attorney in your case, and did he have any direct ties to Karl Rove?
Well, yeah, Dunica Lampton was the U.S. attorney at the time. Lampton was actually a Republican congressional candidate in 2000. He ran for Congress from southern Mississippi. He was defeated. Curiously, Paul Miner had contributed to Dunica Lampton's opponent as he ran for Congress. Upon his loss, George W. Bush appointed Lampton to be U.S. attorney for the Southern District of Mississippi. Mr. Lampton then began investigating Paul Miner, who contributed heavily against Lampton in his congressional campaign. And so we were a little amazed that the investigation was allowed to proceed with Lampton in charge based upon his numerous conflicts. Also, one of his former Lampton's former assistant prosecutors was also known as a guy by the name of Keith Sterrett, who was also a judge in Mississippi, ran for judge later, but he was my opponent in that 2000 election. So there were lots of ties by Lampton and conflicts where he should not have been involved in the investigation at all.
Mm-hmm. And so what were the charges brought against you, and just how solid was the evidence?
Well, I think the jury's verdict speaks to the evidence. I was completely and fully acquitted after a three-month trial. The jury said they reached their decision on me in about 15 minutes. As I said, I had never voted on a case in which Paul Miner or his law firm or any of his associates in his office were ever involved. I think the jury quickly realized that in the trial and returned their verdict very quickly along those lines. Unfortunately, Paul Miner was acquitted on all of those charges that were associated with me, but there were several charges pending against Paul Miner on which the jury hung. They didn't convict him, but they couldn't reach a verdict. So the jury, prosecutors decided to bring a second indictment against Paul Miner, based largely upon honest services cases, which you've also discussed, and the U.S. Supreme Court has recently ruled to be unconstitutional. But Paul Miner was convicted in a second trial based solely on honest services charges. He's been in a federal penitentiary now for 4 years and is awaiting some sort of relief now that the Supreme Court has ruled on that issue.
And they were so vicious toward him that they wouldn't even allow him a compassionate release to visit his wife when she was dying.
Well, Paul Miner was led away from the courtroom in handcuffs for a white-collar criminal. This is largely unheard of. He was shackled. Right after he was incarcerated, his wife was diagnosed with cancer. Unfortunately, she died about 2 years ago. He was not even allowed a visit with at the funeral of his wife. He wanted to deliver the eulogy, but the Department of Justice opposed any release for even that compassionate purpose. Yeah. He even went so far as to offer to pay Department of Justice guards, officials to accompany him and remain shackled during the entire funeral, but they still refused.
Yeah, it's just shameful. Really is. So you were acquitted after the first trial, and then at that point, were you separated from Miner and they took another whack at you on some tax charges?
Yeah, I was, as I said, I was completely exonerated in the first trial, but but Dunica Lampton was so angry that I was acquitted and that he could not convict me. Immediately after the first trial, he said, well, this guy may not have committed bribery, and I didn't prove that, but I'll bet he didn't report his income properly then if he receives all these campaign contributions. I'm going to prosecute him now for tax evasion. So about 6 months after the first trial, I was tried a second time for tax evasion. Again, the jury returned a verdict in about 25 minutes. Acquitting me fully of any tax charges, finding that there were no improprieties in my taxes. I don't even do my taxes. I hire somebody to do them for me. I think the jury, and on top of that, there were no improprieties on my tax returns, and the jury accordingly ruled on that case as well.
And so what was the cost to you, both in personal and financial terms, for these two rounds of misguided prosecution?
Well, as you can imagine, the financial costs were tremendous. But even so, the financial costs aren't the important costs. It just takes a great toll on a person to go through this type of prosecution. I don't know if most people realize it, but I think the statistics are greater than 98% of the folks who are indicted by the federal government will ultimately either plead guilty or be convicted. The odds are greatly stacked against anybody fighting the federal government on criminal charges. I was acquitted not only once but twice. I've got two very young children, or at the time they were very young. They're still fairly young, but I had two young children that I was always concerned about. I was facing 90 years in a federal penitentiary. I was facing several million dollars in fines, all for conduct that I couldn't even imagine I would be charged with. So the costs that it takes are great. I didn't mention, but my wife was actually indicted along with me and Paul Miner. She ran my campaign, as you do in a lot of these small campaigns. You can't afford to hire all these expensive folks to run things for you. So she was involved in the campaign, but she was never involved in any of my decisions. She certainly could not have been involved in any bribery allegations, but she was indicted nonetheless. But prosecutors really weren't even interested in prosecuting her. They came to her fairly quickly and told her that they wanted to make a deal. They simply wanted information about me from my wife, and that was the only way to get it. They told her that we both had small children, and that one of us needed to be home with the children and not both of us go to a federal penitentiary. And they said they would guarantee her that if she would cooperate, that they would not lock her up and they wouldn't fine her or do anything.
And is that fatherly advice or extortion?
Well, I'll let you be the judge. I think it's the modern-day equivalent of Sophie's Choice. Are you going to be with your children, or are you going to go to a federal penitentiary? Mm-hmm. You can imagine the type of strain that places on a family. I actually had to tell her, I said, you've got to do that. You've got to cooperate with them. There's nothing that you can tell these authorities that will hurt me, but I want you to be there for the children in case something does happen to me. And that's the sort of things that you face when you go through these prosecutions.
So after all this, you ran for re-election in 2008, and a Bubba beat you.
Imagine that, a Bubba in Mississippi.
tell us, did they basically damage your reputation? Because we know how this works. The indictments are on the front page, and the acquittals are back there with the obituaries or, next to the box scores.
That's exactly what happened. After 6 years of these massive front page headlines of bribery and corruption and everything else, it was very difficult to run another election. But I wasn't going to back down. I wanted to stand up to them and show them that they were not going to have me cower and slink off. I was going to take them on as many times as it takes, and that's what I'm doing currently. I'm in private practice of law in Mississippi. I represent defendants all around the country who feel that they're unfairly prosecuted by the federal government. I'm glad to do it. I like standing up to the federal government, especially when they bring bogus charges like this. And so I'm going to continue to fight these guys.
Now, you filed a civil suit against Dunn Lampton regarding your, I guess the focus of it would be an improper prosecution, but the narrow issue is that, or at least according to my buddy Roger Schuller at Legal Schnauzer, that your lawsuit in part rests on the fact that Lampton disclosed your tax information to the Mississippi Judicial Performance Commission, but he did so after you had prevailed in the criminal case.
Well, that's exactly correct. I didn't finish actually telling you the entire story. I was prosecuted, like I said, twice, mm-hmm. and acquitted twice. One of the great beauties of the this Rovian scheme using prosecutors to bring political charges is that prosecutors are basically immune from prosecution. You can't bring charges, either civil or criminal, against a prosecutor for performing their functions as a prosecutor. Immunity is almost absolute in regard to the actions of prosecutors. So there really is no remedy. What happened in my case is that Lampton, the prosecutor, was so angry that I was not convicted after two criminal trials that he then took all of the files he had in his office, walked across the street to the Mississippi Commission on Judicial Performance, the commission that investigates judges in the state of Mississippi, dumped all of his documents and told them that, hey, I may not have been able to convict this guy, but he probably did something improper. Here's everything I have. Why don't you guys investigate him and now try to remove him from office that way? Unfortunately for Mr. Lampton, many of the documents that he turned over to the Judicial Performance Commission were mine and my wife's private and our business income tax records. There are specific federal statutes which say that it's a federal felony to publish anyone's tax documents. That's why you never see anybody's income tax returns. It's a federal felony to do that. Lampton was so angry that he simply dumped all of these documents at the Judicial Performance Commission and told them to investigate me. That was the basis for the liability for the lawsuit that we have filed against him. A federal judge has now ruled in our favor saying that, yes, Mr. Lampton was not immune because he stepped out of his role as a prosecutor when he wrongly published all of these documents. Quickly to finish this story, the Judicial Performance Commission did a full investigation, and they dismissed any complaint out of hand, saying they could not find any impropriety as well. So After three investigations, I've still been completely and totally exonerated with any and all allegations.
And I'm sure that you've spent a lot of time pondering this, but I have to ask how you answer the question, why me? When you review all of this and the money that you've lost and the time and personal reputation that has been lost as a result of this, you're a Republican after all. And why would Karl Rove, if he's after Paul Miner, come after you?
Well, I'm going to quickly correct you. I'm no longer a Republican.
Oh, okay.
actually, judges in Mississippi are nonpartisan, and we're not allowed to affiliate with any party. But when I was in the state legislature, I did serve as a Republican.
Mm-hmm.
I find it very difficult to vote for any Republicans now. But to answer the question about why me, I've had time to reflect on it. I don't think that I was the target of the investigation. I think that Paul Miner was the target. I think what was going on was an attempt to cut off the funding for Democratic candidates, not only across the state of Mississippi, but nationwide. They were investigating Democratic donors. I was simply collateral damage in that effort to stop funding of Democratic candidates. I brought the headlines certainly to the case, and it certainly served their purposes to be able to bring these great headlines. But other than that, I think I was just simply collateral damage.
Mm-hmm. And has it shaken your confidence in our criminal justice system? You've now experienced all roles.
Yeah, I always said that I had a great deal of empathy for criminal defendants after I went back to the bench after the prosecution. I looked at criminal prosecutions a lot more skeptically than I did before. You know, folks have always asked me, how do you cope with going through what you've gone through? And, you know, there's not really a simple answer. But, you know, I was a judge. I was a judge on the highest court in the state of Mississippi. I had devoted my life and my practice to the judicial system, the administration of justice, the fair administration of justice. I had to place my faith in the system of justice in order to get through that ordeal. I knew in my heart that if we presented my side of the story to a jury, 12 independent persons, that they would see that I was not guilty and come to the right decision. And in my case, they did, but the problem is, in many cases, they didn't. And in my friend Paul Miner's case, they didn't.
Mm-hmm.
He's sitting in a federal penitentiary and has been now for right at 4 years. He was not involved in any bribery, and even the U.S. Supreme Court has now ruled the statutes that he was convicted under mostly unconstitutional. It was a curious decision, but they said there are problems with honest services prosecutions. So we have people sitting in federal penitentiaries across the United States that that are basically political prisoners.
And the Supreme Court has ordered review of Miner's case. Is that through the Atlanta 11th Circuit?
Actually, they have not ordered review of his case yet. His case is pending before them on a petition for certiorari now. It will be ruled upon in the first week of October when they reconvene. But it is squarely on the honest services issues. But his case is actually out of the Fifth Circuit. Mississippi, Louisiana, and Texas are the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals.
I see. Okay. And I don't know much about the composition of those courts and how they may have ruled on similar cases. I know that Siegelman's had a tough time before the 11th in Atlanta.
Actually, the Fifth Circuit is extremely conservative. They very rarely reverse criminal convictions. However, when the Miner case did go before the Fifth Circuit, they actually reversed many of the charges against Mr. Miner. The only charges left now are the honest services charges, and he has now appealed that to the United States Supreme Court.
Well, then it looks promising, or at least better than it has for 4 years.
And we think so. Yeah, we're very optimistic about it at this point.
And finally, Justice Diaz, tell us about the McTiernan case, where it stands, because he recently pled on a single charge, right?
Well, yes. Well, actually, he pled. There were three charges. There was one telephone call, but they brought three charges out of one telephone call. Mr. McTiernan was home one evening. Actually, he had just returned from a movie shoot in Asia the day before, and answered the phone, and an FBI agent began asking him questions. It was related to the Pelicano private investigator in Hollywood, who was a private investigator to a lot of Hollywood folks.
And he was accused of initiating illegal wiretaps.
Basically wiretap allegations, yes. They wanted to know from John McTiernan whether or not he had employed Mr. Pelicano. John did not really want to answer a lot of questions from the FBI at the time, and basically told them no, that that he didn't want he did not hire Pelicano and didn't want to talk to him, and hung up the phone. Well, he had actually hired Mr. Pelicano at one point, and so they used that as the basis of lying to a federal official, and prosecuted him. He was facing 15 years in a federal penitentiary, based upon this one telephone call from an anonymous FBI agent late one evening at his home. It's amazing to me that the FBI can call you on your phone at home. If they don't like the answers that you give, they can then charge you with lying to a federal official. This is certainly not the same standard that we talked about at the beginning of the phone call that they hold their own employees at the Department of Justice to.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Justice Diaz, in closing, my concern here is that by burying the U.S. attorney's cases and essentially exonerating the Bush administration officials who covered up the politicization of the hiring and firing of U.S. attorneys, that it will bury other cases with it. And conversely, I believe that if we exposed the process that was used, the Wednesday meetings that Rove called at the White House regarding judicial and U.S. attorney appointments, that if we could expose that process, that a lot of other things would unravel. And most importantly, and you may agree or disagree with me on this, I believe that the election in 2004 was stolen in Ohio. And there is a powerful book called Witness to a Crime, a forensic look at actual ballots. Thousands of them are included in the CD-ROM with this book. And even an amateur can see that ballots were crudely changed, the assignment of voting machines was designed to suppress participation by African Americans. There are 150 different ways that the election was gamed or manipulated in Ohio in 2004. And my belief is that if we could unravel the U.S. attorney cases and these phony voter fraud cases that were brought or suggested by White House and DOJ operatives, that it might blow the lid off other issues as well, but most importantly, a stolen presidential election. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think you're exactly correct on trying to expose the things that went on. Unfortunately, I think what we are facing is a current administration that just doesn't have the stomach to conduct the type of investigation that is needed. And I think that goes not only to the current attorney general, but I think it goes all the way to the White House. I think we've heard the thoughts from the White House for a number of years that now that they want to simply move forward and they don't want to look at the past. But that is not the right approach. I mean, we cannot allow the things that have happened in the past to ever happen again. And the only way to prevent that from happening is with a complete and thorough investigation. But unfortunately, I think the current administration doesn't have the stomach to do that.
And Justice Diaz, if I can press you a little, I feel you're being too kind, too diplomatic here. It's not a matter of stomach. To me, you can't declare a holiday on bank robbers or murderers or even speeders. You've got to enforce the law on a consistent and predictable and a transparent basis. And to just selectively say that a whole class of potential crimes shall not be investigated because it's politically inconvenient, I'm sorry, I can't accept that. And when it comes to the more critical issues of illegal wiretapping and surveillance of American citizens and the use of torture and, as Scott Horton has reported, murder against detainees at Guantanamo, that these are things that are not optional. It's not like you can just take them off the table and say, we don't want to go there. So how do we return to constitutional rule?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? I had so much hope when this administration had come in that we were going to turn the pages and look at what had occurred and show the improprieties that had occurred and expose the wrongdoing and bring those to justice who needed to be brought to justice. But after 2 years now of waiting, I think I've given up hope that's going to happen.
Well, I hope you will continue in the cases that you handle and in your own case against Don Lampton to press for as much disclosure and accountability as we can possibly achieve, because I think it's critical for the future of our country. When we look back 20 years from now and say, yeah, Obama buried all that stuff, I'm sorry, these are toxins that only grow more virulent. They don't just become inert.
Absolutely. And you don't get those arguments from the Department of Justice in court when they're prosecuting criminals now, folks that they say are criminals. They certainly wouldn't make that argument, but when you begin to investigate the Department of Justice itself, they will give you those arguments. It's amazing.
Oliver E. Diaz, Jr., former Justice of the Supreme Court in Mississippi, thank you very much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be able to tell my story. Thank you, Peter.
Bonjour, this is Veronique Raskin. I am the CEO of the Organic Wine Company, and I want to personally invite you to join the Peter B. Monthly Organic Wine Club. Call me for the details, and I do answer my phone, at 1-888-ECO-WINE, or visit us at www.theorganicwinecompany.com. À bientôt, j'espère. Merci.
This week, President Obama signed into law the Dodd-Frank financial regulation reforms, trumpeting that these are the most sweeping reforms to our financial system in America's history. I'm one of those people who regards it as C-plus legislation, being fobbed off as an A kind of legislation. But let's turn to somebody who knows a heck of a lot more than I do. William K. Black is a professor and associate professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. And I will forever be grateful to him for his work as a financial regulator. He was general counsel of the Federal Home Loan Bank in San Francisco and also deputy director of the FSLIC back in the 1980s during what became the savings and loan scandal. and he was an actual participant in the meeting of the so-called Keating Five, which involved California Senator Alan Cranston, now deceased, and John McCain, among others. Bill Black, welcome back to the Peter B. Collins Show.
Thank you.
And first, just for a little comparison, how do you compare I like the term Steve Pizzo, our mutual friend, uses, the financiopathic behavior of the 1980s with somewhat similar behavior that occurred in 2007-2008?
The current scandals are much more endemic, and they're much more devastating than at any time in world history, and they're getting worse. So things are awful and headed in the wrong direction.
But we fixed the problem this week because we've set up a new consumer protection agency. Derivatives and other exotic instruments are going to have to be traded on an exchange, except when they're not. and once the industry picks its regulators, they're going to have a really good time with this legislation. Am I right?
Yeah, I thought you were a generous grader. Maybe a D-plus is where I would put this in. It wouldn't have prevented the crisis if it had been adopted 10 years ago. It won't prevent future crises. In general, it doesn't make things worse in most areas, so maybe it's slightly positive, not a complete F. But it doesn't do much positive, and it does some things that are negative.
Now, fundamentally, I was hoping for something that paralleled the Glass-Steagall Act that would make a very bright line or a firewall between the investments made with depositors' money and the bets made with account money held by the banks themselves on the investment side.
Well, you could have made the bill dramatically shorter by adopting a bill that said the following: the Glass-Steagall Law is hereby returned.
That would have been succinct.
That would have been succinct.
Yeah.
And that would have been better on the provisions. So they took a little portion of the Glass-Steagall and they put it back into law, and then, of course, lobbyists weakened it and created exceptions. So it's a shadow of Glass-Steagall. You know, the administration says this is the biggest bill in 80 years, and it's actually true, and that, of course, tells you how bad things have been, that we haven't been able to get any meaningful reform in nearly 80 years. Now, the last meaningful reform that came out of the Great Depression worked really well for 35 years, but this one will be very lucky if it survives 35 months.
Mm-hmm. And have we addressed the fundamentals that led to the so-called meltdown? That's not a very technical term, but that's how the media describes it, which avoids really placing any blame or acknowledging any fraud. It just happened, like so many things in recent years. 9/11 just happened, and the economic meltdown just happened. But I don't believe that this bill really goes to the root causes or the deep viruses that appear to remain in our financial system.
Yeah, that is my fundamental critique. The perverse incentives that cause not just this crisis, but the recurrent intensifying crises have been left in place. And we still have this absurd mindset that, you know, you can't be backward looking and find out what caused the problem. And that's code for no one will be held accountable for defrauding the nation and getting wealthy through fraud and destroying the economy. And that is appalling. I mean, you would never let your kids do that, or they'd turn out to be monsters.
And just to give you a little
accountable,
Professor, just to give you a little context, you can't know this, but the segment that preceded you was a discussion of Nora Dennehy's report saying that we're only going to look forward about the U.S. attorney scandal and not look backward. And we aired that out in some detail. So this is a disease of its own that we have to confront.
Yeah, and I don't understand. I mean, it doesn't make sense under any theory anybody has ever heard. And by the way, the Republicans just announced yesterday and today that if they ever get control of the House, the first thing they're going to do is investigate everybody.
Yeah.
You know, everything the Obama administration ever did or didn't do. So even if they think that this is, avoiding a partisan warfare, it doesn't take two to tango in terms of politics. One will do just fine.
And I don't know if you recall this.
They're going to come after them.
I think I have shared this with you before, but my dad was a classmate of Charlie Keating's in the 40s back in Cincinnati. And, if we compare the Keating case, he was held accountable. And the senators who were involved in the meetings that you attended and reported on, they were at least embarrassed. And in the case of Cranston, there was a censure resolution passed by the United States Senate. And so we can look back with some degree of satisfaction about the financial crimes of the 1980s, that at least some people, maybe not Neil Bush, but some people were held to account for the money that they stole and misappropriated. And it seems that Bernie Madoff is serving as the Charlie Keating of this era, and we're supposed to accept that he's the beginning and the end of financial crimes.
Well, as you say, in that era, for example, Speaker Wright, an immensely powerful person, Speaker of the House, had to resign in disgrace in substantial part because of what he did in the savings and loans. We got over 1,000 priority felony convictions. These aren't tellers. These are the senior people. Over 1,000 felony convictions just out of the savings and loan industry, which only had 3,000 SNLs.
Yeah.
It's not like they were all frauds. And today we have zero convictions, zero of any senior officer at any of the major banks, savings and loans, mortgage banking firms that caused this crisis. That is appalling, and it'll make the next disaster more certain, more severe, and it'll mean that it comes quicker.
And in a commentary that you wrote for CNNMoney.com, you make the point that perverse incentives are really one of the fundamental causes of the problems in our financial sector today. And a quote, "Executive and professional compensation create the motives, while deregulation, desupervision, and regulatory black holes create the opportunity." And the only term that's missing here is greed, or maybe greed and fraud should be included, because we have a situation here, Professor, where as an amateur and somebody who pays attention to the news, but I don't pretend to be an expert on Wall Street or our financial industries, I can see that at some point, the calculations of the people at Goldman Sachs and Citibank at the very top went from a kind of high-leverage, high-stakes gaming concept to downright fraud. Because at some point before they told us, they knew that they were sitting on tranches of toxic mortgages. They knew that the rating agencies had scored some of their investment packages favorably that didn't deserve them. They knew that they were putting out what Carl Levin extracted from one Goldman Sachs executive, a series of shitty deals that they were playing both sides on and expecting AIG to cover any exposure through the insurance and reinsurance that was written there. And so it's very clear to me that there's a class of white-collar criminals who are not only roaming free and continuing to run these industries, but they get to collect fat bonuses every year, too.
Yes, Balzac is attributed with the expression that behind every great fortune lies a great scandal. And most of these people have been made not just wealthy, but fabulously wealthy. And they've learned that they can do so with impunity through fraud. So George Akerlof, Nobel Prize-winning economist at Berkeley, with Paul Romer now at Stanford, wrote an article in 1993 that sums it up really well, and that is looting bankruptcy for profit. The institution fails, but the CEO walks away incredibly wealthy. And what Akerlof and Romer said, and we emphasize in our works in criminology as well, is that fraud is a sure thing, not a risk. If you follow an easy four-step recipe, you are guaranteed to report record profits. And with modern executive compensation, that means that you will become incredibly wealthy. But that same four-part recipe for maximizing fictional income maximizes real losses. So here it is real quick. One, grow like crazy. Two, make loans to people that can't pay you back at a premium yield. Three, leverage out the kazoo. And four, put on only trivial loss reserves against the coming disaster. You do those four things, you are mathematically guaranteed to report record profits. And with modern executive compensation, that means you will be making tens of millions of dollars.
Now, this new bill does attempt to put some limits on executive compensation. It requires, I believe, an advisory vote of shareholders, which seems meaningless to me. But it also is trying to reconstruct or reconfigure corporate boards so that the compensation committee is not completely controlled by insiders. Do you think they've taken steps that will really bring executive compensation back to reality?
No, and both of those steps are really cynical non-steps to make it look like you've done something. The first one, actually in combination, both of them are going to make the world worse because it's going to be a tremendous defense now for any director that says, well, wait a minute, we put it to a vote of the shareholders, and they said yes. The truth is, as we all know in economics and finance and the real world, and that is CEOs dominate the boards, and they dominate any shareholder vote through proxies. And so overwhelmingly, to the tune of well over 90%, CEOs are going to win any votes, and that's going to make it much harder to attack their pay. And whatever you do with the boards, the CEOs are going to end up in control of the boards. There are no truly independent directors on the vast majority of boards. And the CEOs you really have to worry about, of course, make sure that's true, because they make sure they pick somebody who sounds independent and, in fact, is a crony. So those systems, everybody knows, will fail.
And Bill Black, you had a bit of a silver bullet proposal earlier just to reinstate Glass-Steagall. And my equivalent on executive compensation would be to bust a few directors for failure to honor their fiduciary responsibilities. And couldn't we make a significant change without new regulation by getting some of those guys at the SEC to stop watching porn and go pop a couple of corporate directors and set an example that exorbitant executive pay, stock options, whether backdated or not, can be used to basically to fleece the other shareholders. Wouldn't it change things if we simply enforced the fiduciary rules that are on the books?
Not very much. First, Delaware has gotten rid of the fiduciary duty of care. Or more precisely, it's allowed corporations to do away with it, and often they did, like Lehman Brothers. So that whole duty doesn't even exist. We should prevent that by federal statute, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Second, the SEC effectively could only bring actions where there wasn't disclosure, and that would bring in the backdating, and they've only brought roughly 20 of those actions, and it's estimated that there are more on the order of at least 2,000 cases of backdating stock options. So there's no way that that's going to happen as a practical matter. Mm-hmm. Third thing, the FDIC has a rule that would actually restrict compensation in the right way. It says, fine, you want to pay based on compensation, make it long-term performance, not short-term performance. And that vote in favor of proposing that FDIC rule only passed 3-2. because both the head of the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency and the head of the Office of Thrift Supervision voted against any attempt to get compensation fixed. And I would note that both of those gentlemen report to one Timothy Geithner, Treasury Secretary. They're both bureaus within Treasury. So behind the scenes, the administration has been trying to kill any effective regulation of compensation.
Yeah. And since you mentioned Timmy Geithner, what is your level of confidence in the Treasury Secretary?
I am confident that he has failed at everything in life and will continue to do so.
That's a great way to put it. Recently, he appeared on the PBS NewsHour, and it was so infuriating to me that I took the audio and played it back here on the show and gave my responses to Mr. Geithner, many of which I had been screaming at the television set the night before. But in fundamental terms, it really, his appointment and his continuation in the job indicates to me that Democrats are not at all serious about fixing the underlying problems or ferreting out real fraud in the system. They essentially just rebuilt the sandcastles that had crumbled as they were entering office.
Yeah, I mean, look at multiple levels. First, he was the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York.
Right.
That was supposed to regulate many of the largest banks and bank holding companies in America. It was an abject failure. It didn't take any effective action. He made no warnings. He was absolutely clueless in the biggest crisis in virtually everybody alive. Right. So he's tried and he's failed, and he has a past history of failing in other crises as well. So he was picked because he was a failure, not because he was a success. He was willing to say whatever his bosses wanted him to say. Second, look at integrity. Geithner is somebody who was very wealthy at the World Bank, and the World Bank does a thing called grossing up your salary in that era so that whatever taxes you would have to pay, they give you an extra salary bump so that you end up effectively as if you had no U.S. taxes. Well, Geithner didn't declare that salary bump as income, and that's just plain wrong, right? So when he's about to be appointed the president of the Federal Reserve, they catch him on this, and he refuses to pay back the money that he was supposed to pay because the portion of it that was beyond the statute of limitations. In other words, if I can get away with cheating the government, I will. Now, that guy is now in charge of the IRS. Why would we pick somebody with the morals that would embarrass an alley cat to be head of Treasury? It's beyond belief. And then since then, he, with Bernanke and with Summers and with Hank Paulson before under the Bush administration,
right,
have led these giveaways to Goldman Sachs through AIG, the secret bailouts of Goldman Sachs, to pay them 100 cents on the dollar. And the entire cover-up of the scale of this disaster. You know, they phonied up the accounting rules on banks so they don't have to recognize their losses. And so, of course, they report record profits. And that's the only thing that allows the Citicorps of the world to pay these huge bonuses to their officers. If they had to account honestly, they would be reporting that they were insolvent. You know, and for that, Geithner claims that he saved the world and we should be praising him. Well, no, that's why economies don't improve. Because as long as you're lying about the numbers, which is the Japanese strategy, the market's never clear. And so, you know, the Japanese lost decade is now two lost decades. The Nikkei, the Japanese equivalent of the Dow Jones, is still roughly 25% of its peak value 20 years ago. So think of the Dow Jones losing 75% of its value and staying there for 20 years. That's the kind of crisis that Geithner and Summers and Bernanke and Paulson before him have been setting the nation up for.
Bill, I'd like to get your take on a specific question. Nomi Prinz has been a guest of mine several times. She was a managing director of Goldman and has written a book called It Takes a Pillage. And she estimates that the actual amount of cash and assumed liabilities that our government has extended to the financial industry is somewhere in the zone of $12 to $14 trillion. And I'd like to know if you agree with that estimate, and if Geithner and Bernanke, who won reconfirmation earlier this year, if they've been honest with the American people about what they've actually done.
Well, they certainly haven't been honest. Everything has been designed to keep things as opaque as possible. I was one of the strong supporters of the provision that did get through, by the way, to audit the Fed. And there is a little hope out of the bill that we'll start getting some of the facts, but we don't know is the answer. We know that it's in the trillions, but we don't know how many trillions have been made available. Now, that figure isn't just for U.S. banks, folks should know. I mean, if you're concerned about illegal aliens, I mean, you should certainly be concerned that we have sent literally trillions of dollars of U.S. aid to foreign banks,
mm-hmm.
Without any vote, without any disclosure, and in ways that probably won't this time around result in additional large losses, but could. In other words, we're exposed to credit risk,
mm-hmm.
on the way those extensions have been made. And we have done outright bailouts. In addition to bailing out Goldman Sachs through AIG, we bailed out UBS, for example. And UBS was in the midst. We were bringing a felony action against UBS for working together with a number of, tens of thousands of wealthy Americans to evade taxes. So at the same time we were prosecuting them for fraud and would ultimately settle for a fine, we gave them roughly 10 times as much money as their fine. So in essence, we paid the fine to ourselves.
Oh, boy.
And then gave them 9 times as much walking away change.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, again, a huge bank that has been one fraud after another. If the three strikes law applied to any of these places, they would have been out of business years ago. And last I looked, the Swiss are not a poor nation. They could bail out their own banks.
Now, Professor, you referenced the audit of the Fed, and I recall the proposal from Ron Paul in the House and Bernie Sanders in the Senate. How much of their original proposal survived, and is this going to be a meaningful audit of the Federal Reserve, in your opinion?
Well, enough authority survived to make a meaningful audit. There's always the question, of course, will the GAO actually tear the place apart the way you should to get the real answers? And when I say tear the place apart, I just mean not settle for, it's been obvious that the Fed hates the idea of being audited and intends to be obstructionist. And I mean, you have to break through all of those efforts at obstruction. And we'll see whether the GAO has the guts to do that.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things I referenced earlier is that the industry will next attempt to pick the regulators who are newly empowered by this new legislation. And one who is quite prominent is Elizabeth Warren. And I've never met or talked to her, but I'm so impressed with her appearances on television in particular, because she is a remarkably frank woman and really seems to know what she's talking about. Now, Geithner made some convoluted rhetorical statements earlier this week, trying not to appear that he is opposed to Elizabeth Warren, but in the same breath said that there's some other great people who have experience on the street who will probably be, more predictable and less likely to make waves. What is your take on Elizabeth Warren and her prospects for heading this new consumer protection agency that she basically conceptualized?
Well, she not only conceptualized, this has been her area of work for decades, and she is an internationally renowned scholar for her work. She's, you know, a full professor at one of the most prestigious academic institutions in the world, and people are saying that she might not be confirmable. Now, this is in contrast to Chainsaw Gillerin, Bush's first appointment to run the Office of Thrift Supervision, the guy who comes to the press conference holding a chainsaw, standing next to the three leading bank lobbyists in America with pruning shears, and they're all posed and poised over a pile of federal regulations to demonstrate their intention to destroy all federal regulation. And they're proud of this. They're proud that the regulators are working with the industry to destroy regulation. And that guy got through confirmation with no opposition. And now we have one of the top people in the world, and they're saying that they won't confirm her?
Well, and that meme is being promoted by Democrats.
Well, who? Do you consider Geithner a Democrat? Right. The Reuben wing of the party is wholly Republican in their orientation towards economics.
Mm-hmm.
And they are appalled at the idea of Elizabeth Warren getting that position. And Geithner, of course, personally has a lot of scar tissue because of the things Elizabeth Warren has disclosed about Geithner.
Mm-hmm.
And so he, behind the scenes, everybody knows, is working diligently to try to make sure that she's never appointed. And they're trying to put instead a couple of Treasury apparatchiks from the Reuben wing. And if they do, they will have succeeded in knocking out that agency. But remember, we are 18 months in. And you said earlier, you know, aren't there a lot of things we could have done without waiting for the passage of legislation? And you're absolutely right. 99% of the things that needed to be done could have been done without any new legislation. And so what would a president that really wanted to change things have done? Well, everybody knows it's leadership. So he would have appointed new heads. Instead, he left in charge the same guy who was infamous at the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, the guy that was infamous at the Office of Thrift Supervision. Both of them are still there, right? The one at OTS is an acting that's been in charge for 17 months or so. The person who was in charge of regulating Fannie and Freddie, now there's a disaster if you've ever heard one,
mm-hmm.
was a personal friend of George Bush going back to high school days. He was left in by Obama. He's been replaced simply because he left on his own terms by his deputy, and Obama has appointed no one. I mean, this is a $400 billion disaster, and he's left in place the failed Bush regulators, what Tom Frank aptly calls the wrecking crew.
Yeah.
Now, under what conceivable logic would you leave in charge all of these disasters for a year and a half?
And on that basis,
and it's surprising that there are zero criminal referrals that have come out of the Office of Thrift Supervision and the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, zero criminal referrals in a decade.
And on that basis, it's hard to have any confidence that Obama will appoint Warren and shield her or support her through a confirmation process. We just saw this week how this woman in Georgia in the Agriculture Department was forced to resign because of another Breitbart video mashup that, was promoted by Fox News. And this administration really lacks the courage to confront its opponents and really fight. And we saw it with Van Jones. We saw it with the Acorn case and now with this woman. And I wanted to see a much more liberal justice appointed to the Supreme Court, And we see through this process that Kagan really sailed through almost unscathed, and he could have put some political capital at risk and really replaced Justice Stevens with a like-minded individual.
Oh, I mean, it's on so many different levels there. I mean, there actually are studies of the Supreme Court by conservatives that show that the conservative members of the Supreme Court include four of the five most conservative members that have ever served in 120 years. Right? So we have the most ultra-extreme, and the MEM, of course, is of activist liberal judges.
Right.
And there hasn't been a liberal judge on the court in 15 years. They're all centrists if they're appointed by Democrats. But, yes, anything that comes out of the Rubin, Summers, Geithner wing is going to be horrific. And this administration doesn't even stand behind its people when its people are in the right. It's the land of the invertebrates.
Yeah. Finally, Bill Black, regarding this financial reform bill, the whole concept of too big to fail is something that's been bandied about. And despite the language used, we've created bigger monsters. And even though we're told that we'll never have to bail out a bank or an insurance company again, I don't believe that. It sounds like bullshit to me. And it really seems that as the banks beat back the proposed $18 billion tax fund that was supposed to be the money used to bail out a company short term and wind it down and break it up, that whole process was turned on its ear when the bank lobbies succeeded in stripping out that tax.
Yeah, I mean, it's nuts, because under normal Republican theory, this should have been considered a user charge. And Republicans are supposed to love user charges, but the lobbyists changed all that. The president, I mean, it's just inconceivable what he said, that this passage of this bill means there'll never be a bailout. There's nothing in this bill that will prevent future bailouts. Nothing at all. And indeed, there will be new bailouts within weeks, because the FDIC is going to be issuing bonds that it can't pay for. So the only way they can be paid for is by the Treasury, which is the taxpayers, which is to say there's a bailout and it's going to be happening within weeks of what he said. The systemically dangerous institutions, the administration can't even call them by that right name. It calls them systemically important, like they deserve a gold star. But the SDIs, they are, under the administration's own logic, they pose a systemic danger. What the administration is telling us is if any one of these 19 banks fail, it will cause not just a U.S., but a global crisis. Now, there are zero economies of scale at this size. In other words, all of these banks would be more efficient if they were much smaller.
Right.
So tell me, why would we ever allow them to continue to exist? We're rolling the dice every day under the administration's logic, wondering when they're going to blow up and cause a global crisis. We get zero benefits out of making them this big, lots of advantages of making them smaller. And after a financial crisis that required trillions of dollars of losses and trillions of dollars of bailouts, much of it secret, as we've discussed, they can't even get themselves change and deal effectively with the systemically dangerous institutions. In fact, they've actually weakened our ability to close those institutions by requiring us to prove a grave danger to the world from them existing, which is going to be impossible to prove in the practical sense.
Mm-hmm. Well, Bill Black, thank you for joining me today. I appreciate your coherence and clarity and criticism. And I will accept your friendly amendment and reduce my grade from a C-plus to a D-plus after consulting with you.
Okay.
William K. Black, Associate Professor of Economics and Law, University of Missouri, Kansas City. Thank you, Bill.
Thank you.
And it's quite a ritual. We usually end every podcast here at the Peter B. Collins Show with Roy Rogers' Happy Trails. But after the two topics we discussed on this program, I've got a fresh song I'd like you to check out. I have no idea who the Flying Turbulon Orchestra is or are or where they came from, but I heard them on Pandora. And this song is called Don't Be Fooled. Whether it's about U.S. attorneys or the financial recovery and reform, call bullshit when you see it. Don't be fooled. Send me an email, peter@peterbcollins.com.
Honest, we could say we're fine, but there's no use lying. Don't be fooled while the rain is drying. If we stay, there'll be more just like it. The storm will find it.
Inside, but there's no use hiding. Don't be fooled by the sun.